Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 167 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Cebulski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. While every king and queen has some sort of an impact on their country, there are few whose reign serves to completely redraw the map. One of these kings was Philip II, called Augustus, who ruled over France for over 4 decades, from 1179 to 1223. As a teenage king, a crusader, and according to some, a bigamist, Philip's life story is filled with enough saintliness and scandal to satisfy the appetites of any medieval chronicler. Luckily for us, a monk named Rigaud was on the case. This week, I spoke with Dr. M. Cecilia Gaposchkin and Dr. Sean L. Field about the life of Philip Augustus, as recorded by contemporary monk. Cecilia is the chair of the Department of History at Dartmouth College and the author of Invisible Weapons, Liturgy and the Making of Crusade Ideology, and The Making of St. Louis, Kingship, Sanctity, and Crusade in the Late Middle Ages. Sean is a professor of history at the University of Vermont and a fellow of the Medieval Academy of America. His books include Les Passeurs du Temps, Mélange offert à Jacques Delarun, and Courting Society, Holy Women and the Capetians. Together, Cecilia and Sean are the editors of The Deeds of Philip Augustus, an English translation of Rigaud's Gesta Philippi Augusti, which was translated by Dr. Larry F. Field. Larry is a professor emeritus of criminal justice at Western New England University and has translated several books, including The Sanctity of Louis IX, Early Lives of Louis IX by Geoffrey of Beaulieu and William of Chartres. Although I only spoke with Cecilia and Sean this week, it's Larry's translation that made this episode possible. Our conversation on Philip Augustus, his deeds and misdeeds, and his massive impact on both French history and geography is coming up right after this. Well, thank you, Sean and Cecilia, for coming on to tell us all about the deeds of Philip Augustus. It's really nice to meet you.
Thanks, Danielle. It's great to meet you after listening to you for so long.
Thanks.
Thanks for having us on the show, Danielle.
My pleasure. Okay, so we are going to be looking at a chronicle that was written by a monk. Can you tell us about the chronicler himself?
Maybe I'll start, and Sean, you can correct me when you remember things differently. So Rigaud, he's a monk at an abbey called Saint-Denis, Benedictine Abbey, which is just about 6 miles north of Paris. We don't know much about him, except for what he tells us himself. And what he tells us in his own writing, this is really the chief thing that we have of his. There's some other smaller pieces of writing that he's done. But what he tells us in his writing is that he is a physician, that he was trained as a physician, that he is gothicus, so a goth, and that he is the chronographer of the kings of France. He also tells us that he had started the chronicle at an earlier stage, and we sort of understand a bit about his life cycle and its relationship to the writing of the chronicle and to Philip's reign by sort of triangulating with that evidence that he put the work aside for a while and then picked it up again. And by that, we understand that he had worked as a doctor, probably he was from the South, that he had come to Paris at some point, that he worked as a doctor. It doesn't seem to have gone well for him, that professional tract. Another doctor made fun of him for practicing medicine badly at one point. And so he was apparently having a hard time making ends meet. And that at some point he joined the abbey at Saint-Denis. And Saint-Denis itself was an extremely important institution, a monastic institution. In this period, your listeners will know that much writing, intellectual work happened within a monastic context. And he joined this institution, which took seriously historical writing and was developing a real tradition of historical writing at this time. And I guess the only other obvious thing to say is that sitting in about 2005, 2006, he calls himself sort of an older man, on the cusp of old age. And so we assume he was born, what is it calculated? Probably around 1160 or so, 1150. Sean, I'm looking for Sean for confirmation, and that he would have been what we would call middle age by the around 1200 when he was active. Sean, what am I missing?
That seems quite good. So in other words, Rigaud is in some ways typical of a medieval chronicler in that he's a monk, he's writing from a monastic perspective, but he's also somewhat unusual in that he has this background as a physician, somewhat mysterious in that we really don't know how he made that transition from being a practicing physician to a monk, or why, or under what circumstances. And it does give him a little bit of a quirky kind of a perspective on things. So he's an extremely interesting observer and chronicler of the reign of this king, Philip Augustus.
Yeah, this is an interesting chronicle, I think, written by a doctor, where there's at least one point where the prince is sick and he says they call it dysentery, where usually, you know, it's the prince is sick with some mysterious ailment. But it's funny that he's writing with his perspective as a doctor. We need to say what this is, because then you know how important it is. All right. So we've got an idea of who's writing it. He's a doctor. He's a monk. He's living to the north of Paris. So he's right in the heart of things, and he's writing contemporarily with the king that he's chronicling. Okay, so let's talk about Philip Augustus. Why is he somebody that a chronicler would think, oh, I need to write about and call Augustus?
Sean, why don't you take this one?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. If Rigaud started writing about 1180 or so, he's beginning to write just as Philip is being crowned King of France, just as Philip's father, King Louis VII, dies. So in other words, when Rigaud began to write, Philip hadn't really done very much yet. It wasn't necessarily clear whether he would be, you know, a consequential king of France or not. He simply happened to be the king of France when Rigaud started to write. In retrospect, of course, we know that Philip was one of the most consequential kings of France in the Middle Ages for a number of reasons that Rigaud chronicles very closely. One being Philip being the first king of any medieval Christian kingdom to expel en masse the Jews from his kingdom, a really fateful decision he took early in his reign. Perhaps the most clear and definitive thing that he is remembered for is his decisive victories over King John of England and retaking large parts of what we would think of as Western France that the kings of England had held for half a century. And maybe the other thing to add is just that precisely because Philip was king of France at a moment when European culture and government and education and literacy was rapidly changing, he also oversaw the emergence and the beginnings of a true bureaucratic government of France, which may not have been particularly due to his own personal decisions. It might have been due more simply to the generation in which he ruled. But certainly this period of several decades that Rigaud is chronicling is the period in which a really functioning French royal government begins to emerge.
I'll add, not because it brings glory to his reputation, but among the great events of his reign, he was one of the participants in the Third Crusade. And a lot of the stories that come around from him revolve around his marital escapades and other narrative aspects that are quite interesting that give color. So as part of the, for instance, the centralization and bureaucratization of the work of government, we begin to see the Capetian, Philip is a Capetian, that's the dynasty, the sort of centralization of Capetian administrative apparatus in Paris. And we usually look to this period as the moment where Paris really becomes the center of the capital of the kingdom. And one of the things Rigaud gives us a lot of color for, some of the just the stories and the anecdotes around these developments as well, that are perhaps more interesting to not somebody like Rigaud, a contemporary who's just describing them, but has been really honed in on by later historians looking at broader trends.
Let's dig into that for a second, because I think that his influence on Paris can't really be underestimated. So what are some of the things that he did to improve Paris during his reign? He did quite a lot of things, so let's just pull some of them out. He had a long reign, so there's lots that he did.
Probably the most famous anecdote is his decision to pave the streets and squares of Paris. And it's also a good example of Rigaud's flair as a storyteller, because the way he tells it is that Philip was in his palace on the Ile de la Cité, and he was looking out the window overlooking the Seine. And so anyone who knows Paris can sort of picture exactly where he was and what he's seeing as he looks out the window. And he is essentially grossed out, because not only are the streets of Paris muddy, but as the horse-drawn carts go through the streets, they stir up the stench of the mud. And Philip decides there and then that he has to bring it about that the streets will be paved with, you know, obviously not with modern, you know, concrete, but with paving stones, with strong stones that will lessen this stench. And Rigaud tells us that his His point was he wanted to change the reputation of the city, which had anciently been called Lutatia, a Roman name, which Rigord at least believes was based on the Latin word for mud, lutum. So it would no longer be known as Mud City, but rather as Paris.
One of the other things that Rigord talks a lot about is building walls. He puts walls around areas of Paris and some woods, but most famously before he leaves for a crusade, and understanding that there's this long enduring difficulty or danger from the Angevins, from the English kings, he decides to erect walls around the city of Paris. And interestingly, Paris had had walls earlier, but was not at that point walled. And there's still some remnants of the wall. It's a massive endeavor. So he begins by, and it's Rigaud who chronicles this verse, he builds by building a half circle, if you will, above the Seine, what we would call the right bank, which, if you can sort of picture the map of France, if there was going to be an attack from the north, from the Angevin lands, it would come from that direction. And then when he returned from the crusade, he continued by encircling the left bank as well. It's also at this point that he begins the Louvre, which is the part of essentially that project, which is a fortress essentially at the edge of the wall. And that is probably one of the things that most decisively locks in the medieval Paris, the shape of medieval Paris, and then the different aspects of its topography from the 13th century onwards. I mean, until Haussmann, obviously, is going to put in his big boulevards.
Yeah, well, this is one of the good things, as Sean was saying, about the chronicle. It's very evocative. And so he says things like, well, who would have thought that you could pave the entire city of Paris? Only Philip could do it. Only he has the audacity to say, you know what? It's too muddy. It's too stinky. Let's just pave the whole thing.
You know, the other thing he had, Rigord wouldn't have had the distance to be able to see this, but he had the wealth to do it. And so another point, if we sort of draw back a bit from Rigord and think about Philip's reign, is just the coming out of the 12th century and the 12th century Renaissance and the essentially increasing productivity of Europe as a whole, that and then the developing administrative skills of the monarchy to trap some of that growing wealth is permitting him to take on these big projects. The other thing to note, it's a frequently cited fact, I don't know how the numbers are calculated, but starting from Philip's reign up until the reign of his great-great-grandson, Philip the Fair, Paris is going to grow tenfold in population. And it is precisely Philip's, what we would call urban management or urban planning, that's partly going to allow for that.
Yeah, and one of the things that I think really consolidates the power in Paris that's actually mentioned in the chronicle, and it's really important, but it happens a bit later, is that all the documents are copied and they're all kept. So there's a funny story about why that happens. Can you tell us why they start copying things and keeping them in Paris?
Sure. The traditional story is that in 1194, Philip lost a decisive battle to his great rival, Richard the Lionheart of England. And in the chaos of that defeat, the royal baggage train was lost. And up to that point, the kings of France had just been carrying whatever documents they had sort of along with them as they traveled. And so he'd lost all his key documents. And so from that point on, the French crown began the process of a more centralized, bureaucratized archiving of royal documents. And also as part of the same general process, of keeping better track of outgoing documents, of keeping copies in registers. So this is a good example of what we mean by the Philip's reign being really the beginnings of functioning bureaucracy for the French royal government. But it began with a defeat. So in some ways, it's not a glorious story for Philip.
We brought up the specter of Richard. So let's go there. In many chronicles, even Arabic chronicles, Richard turns out looking pretty good. But in this one, he does not. So let's dig into Philip going on crusade. So first of all, there is a call for crusade. And Philip hears the call, but he doesn't go right away. Let's talk about Philip heading out on crusade. How did that work out?
Yeah, Philip doesn't seem to have been a natural crusader. So the Third Crusade was launched after Jerusalem fell to Salah ad-Din in 1187. It's one of the great narratives. The crusade was really initially focused on trying to recover the city of Acre. Jerusalem itself doesn't have any particular strategic value or importance. And for the crusaders and the crusader kingdom of Jerusalem to have a leg to stand on, it needed to begin by recovering the coastal port. And Philip took the cross and went and joined the siege of Acre that had already begun. Philip and Richard were already fighting and they had to sort of kiss and make up. The tensions were high, but they put aside their European differences in order to make common cause in recovering Jerusalem. But they clearly didn't get along. Philip was still quite young at this point. He had had battle experience, but he hadn't made a reputation through his battle experience. Obviously, later he has these battles that really establish himself as a kind of conqueror. But at this period, whether it's really an uninteresting crusade with personal disinterest or personal dislike of Richard or whatever, or youth or something, he seems to have been unengaged. You wouldn't know that from reading Rigel's Chronicle, though, who really tries to use this as one of the propaganda pieces, because, of course, crusading was a feature and warfare was a feature of kingship, and particularly Capetian kingship at this point. And the idea that he should go on crusade would be a natural sort of opportunity to discuss the ways in which he's great. In reality, it's clear that he and Richard didn't get along when they were at Acre, that Richard was about 10 years older than him, much more competent, much more charismatic. And one gets the impression that as soon as he could, Philip just kind of swept his hands of it and called it a victory and left.
The Third Crusade is, of course, you know, one of the most famous, often retold moments in medieval history. And if you're looking for accurate eyewitness accounts of the Third Crusade, you wouldn't turn to Rigord. He didn't go himself. It's not an objective view whatsoever, but it's still an extremely important perspective on the Third Crusade, precisely because Rigord gives us the view from France. What did the loyal followers of the King of France want to remember about the Third Crusade? How did they want to portray it? And so he does give us a pretty detailed account, but it's the sort of account that you get from back at home, like trying to make Philip Augustus seem like the great glorious warrior, and at every turn denigrating Richard as untrustworthy and sneaky and probably in some kind of cahoots with the Saracens. And
yeah.
So it's the French retelling of the Third Crusade. And for that, it is a valuable account.
Yeah, it's pretty funny where he's saying, well, Philip went home because he was sick and, you know, he had kingly things to do. At home.
He went home for some very good reasons. I mean, it was clear Richard's younger brother, John, who would ultimately be King John, and whom he would fight not all that long after in Normandy and then later at Bouvines, was looking at northern France. That's why he had built the walls. And it was clear, whatever reports he was getting, that things weren't necessarily secure back in France. For what it's worth, Richard was also quite ill, probably much more ill than Philip. When Philip left, he may well have needed to get home. I mean, it may have been that there was, in fact, governance that needed to happen and dangers facing him. But then within his reign, there's many other crusading opportunities. Both the Fourth Crusade and the Fifth Crusade are called before he dies, and he doesn't participate in either of them, as is the Albigensian Crusade. He is supportive of the efforts, but he himself has no interest in going. And one gets the impression that crusading as a practice is just not something that appealed to him very much. Maybe because the experience had been so soured by bickering with or being outshone by Richard the Lionheart in the East. Yeah. Richard, who really did know what he was doing as a general, as a military leader.
Well, what people might not know or might not remember is that Philip took some petty revenge. After that, maybe not so petty revenge, because when Richard tried to come home, Philip was doing pretty much everything he could to keep him in captivity, right?
Yeah, it was Philip and also Leopold of Austria, who Richard had insulted in the East. And on his way, when he had to come home himself before recapturing Jerusalem, which they never did, he was captured by Leopold of Austria, who handed him over to the emperor. And he was in captivity for the better part of a year and a half? And Philip did everything he could to encourage the continuation of that captivity.
Well, before we leave the Third Crusade behind, one of the most important things in this chronicle is the Saladin tithe, which is in there, as well as Philip's testament. He's trying to get things in order before he goes on crusade. So can you tell us about some of these documents that are written, we think, kind of in full in this chronicle?
Yeah, in particular, the testament and we might say, constitution, the governmental document setting out how France was to be governed in Philip's absence, is of extraordinary importance in the emergence of a kind of quasi-constitutional view of like how the French monarchy should work. And it only survives because Rigord included a copy of it in his chronicle. So we don't have an original document. A number of copies must have been made at the time, but none of them survive. We only have it because Rigord included it. It's one of the things that makes his chronicle just absolutely essential for understanding the development of the French monarchy. So that's an extremely useful part of this text. If you have students reading it as a kind of a narrative and a record of a lot of battles that are happening and some sort of fast-paced things, and you're getting excited about the king going off on crusade, it can actually seem like a little bit of a pause or a parenthesis of like, Rigord pauses to give you this very technical governmental document, but it's absolutely essential to have it there. And the same thing with the Saladin Tithe, although I think we have other copies of that document, but it's a technical, it inserts the sort of the legal language. I mean, a tax document doesn't make great reading. It has a lot of clauses. And the quick answer is usually that the Saladin Tithe was just that 10% of wealth was taxed to raise money for the crusade. But when you actually read it, you see that it's a much more complicated document and envisioning all sorts of contingencies. What if a young man takes the cross, but his father doesn't, and the lands are in his father's name, then who has to pay the tithe sort of thing? So, they're governmental documents, they're tax documents. So they're quite technical. And this might be a good moment for a quick shout out to our translator, Larry Field, who had to deal with the complexities of the several different registers of Rigord's Latin in this text and try to smooth them all out. And so this was one of the places where we had a lot of fun going back and forth with our translator, Larry, and trying to arrive at nice, smooth readings that captured all the technical language of these sort of inserted documents, but also made them readable for a modern American audience. So well done, Larry.
Yes,
no, it's true. I mean, I have to say my Latin is decent, but that legal language, it can be pretty impenetrable. And he did a marvelous, as he did throughout, but he did a marvelous job, again, with capturing the different types of language, the different tenor or timbre of the different types of documents, as well as the narrative.
Yeah, I mean, also, huge shout out to him.
Just a quick further singing of Larry's praises. He was trained as a classicist, he has a PhD in classics, but later in his career, he was a practicing lawyer. And so he had a particular interest whenever this sort of legal questions would come up. He really enjoyed digging into them and making sure that we didn't gloss over some of the legal details and administrative details. And another translator who's more literary oriented might have thought those were the boring things to just sort of move over as quickly as possible. But Larry is particularly good about digging into those kind of things.
Well, as you say, it's so important because those contingencies, I think, are really essential, especially when you have this myth that people back in the day were not very smart, or they just like didn't think about these things, where all these contingencies are in place. Like, if this person goes on crusade, as you're saying, who pays this tithe for him? And so it's incredible reading, and it's actually very readable. Big shout out to Larry for that.
Just to continue on the nature of that document, you begin to see, in fact, how sophisticated the social system, that I don't just mean the government, which we're seeing in action here, trying to implement new structures of control, of wealth management, of taxation, of collection, of bookkeeping. And so for that, it's an interesting document. But because of all the contingencies of land ownership and different types of fealty and different types of obligations, one can see this is, in fact, they're very different from our own, an incredibly sophisticated social system. And using documents like that permit you to begin to understand actually how complex and both robust but interconnected that system is, in a way that I think often surprises students. But to stay on documents for a minute, one of the interesting things is, how did Rigord, as a monk sitting in a monastery north of Paris, have access to these? And what does that say about record keeping, about his process, about how he had access to that and some of the other documents when he included it? That itself is a sort of way of trying to get into what his process were, what his sources were, how reliable. It is understood that that is a reliable piece. He even reproduces the signature and the seal at the end to kind of, of the narrative, and to somehow gesture to its authenticity, which would have been the seal would have been the authenticating element of a piece of parchment that had it written on it. And he tries to reproduce that. But it opens up all these questions about his sourcing, his process, what he was looking at, where he was looking at them, what they had at Saint-Denis, the extent to which Saint-Denis was being used in an archival sense, what they had at the palace, and his own process.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating to think about that, because some of the details he gets wrong, and you know it's hearsay, he's heard from someone else, but things like this where it seems to be verbatim, like, how is he getting these sources? I think that's really fascinating, which is why I don't want to forget him as a chronicler. I'm going to switch directions, though, and head to the spicier stuff, because I mostly read in the 14th century, and I didn't know all that much about his marital issues. So let's switch into that for a minute. So Philip, he has a bunch of marital issues. Let's talk about his relationships. Where does he start as a king? Who does he marry first?
His first wife is Isabel of Hainaut, so the daughter of Count Baldwin of Hainaut. And they are married right at the very beginning of Philip's reign. And they do produce one son, the future Louis VIII of France. But then Isabel dies just before Philip goes off on the Third Crusade, which does mean, in passing, that means that when he goes off on crusade, you know, the future of the French monarchy is really somewhat shaky. He has one infant son and no current wife. So when he returns, it's important for dynastic reasons that he marries again and tries to produce more heirs. And he selected the sister of the current king of Denmark at the time, a woman named Cecilia. How will we be pronouncing her name? Ingeborg? Ingeborg of Denmark. And so, you know, they had not met face to face until the actual day of the marriage. They were married. And the next day, Philip declared quite clearly that he intended to annul the marriage and did not wish to remain married to this woman. And from that day to this, there's been a fair amount of mystery over exactly what could have happened on their wedding night that was so dramatic that Philip had very, very clear intentions to rid himself of this woman. And at the time, the best explanations were perhaps some kind of sorcery or something had occurred. And, you know, more or the obvious sorts of slightly salacious, but obvious sorts of conclusions are that something had not gone particularly well in the marital bed that night. But without getting into too many hypothetical details, one wonders what exactly could have been so wrong that the King of France absolutely was convinced that he could not stay married to this woman. So he was able to get a compliant group of French churchmen to annul the marriage under the fiction that they were too closely related. The church had very strict rules at the time about how closely related man and wife could be. But the dynamic new pope at the time, Innocent III, was not willing to go along with this fiction. And so Philip ends up battling with the papacy and also certainly with Ingeborg and her relatives. Ingeborg refused to go along with this fiction and kept up a legal battle for years. So it became a very long, drawn-out battle between Philip and the papacy, during which he actually married, at least according to his own definition, he married another woman and had several children with her. So it became quite a controversial mess around his marital choices.
Yeah, it's funny because in the chronicle, Rigaud is saying, well, she's a saintly woman, she's beautiful, and then they get married and the devil intervenes because he cannot figure out either why they can't stay married. But Philip is absolutely not going to do it. And this ends up being a huge issue for all of France, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the Pope gets involved at this point in 1198. One of the other great figures of medieval history, Pope Innocent III, ascends the papal throne, becomes Pope, and isn't at all pleased about this. And at one point, actually, the whole of France was under interdict, which is a real issue. It meant that people couldn't have communion, people couldn't worship and participate in the core salvific ritual of their faith. But he had his own churchmen in his back pocket who were, I think Sean called them, compliant.
Yeah, and certainly one of the interesting things here as you're reading Rigaud's text is that at about this time, Rigaud gets notably less adulatory in the way he describes Philip. Like he definitely sides with Ingeborg. He definitely doesn't understand why Philip's done this, doesn't approve of this. And in the second half of his chronicle, he's certainly still a, you know, a strong supporter of the king, but criticism creeps in much more clearly than it does in the first half. And this is really the, at least one of the main turning points for Rigord in terms of a little bit of a souring of his opinion of the king.
What was surprising to me, not having known all that much about this, is eventually Philip marries another woman and they're together. They have some children for a while, but then he goes and takes back Ingeborg at the pleading of everybody. And there's this whole big council, at least according to Rigord. And he says, oh, I'm tired of this. I'm just going to leave with Ingeborg. We're married. It's fine. We're just going to stay together. And everyone's like, oh, we were going to grant you a divorce, but okay.
So Philip's third wife was named Agnes of Mehan, and she dies in 1201. I'm just looking at our genealogy that we included in the book to get my dates right, which did open up the possibilities. And the sense might be that Philip had grown a bit. He had tired of all the hoopla. It's just too much trouble. And it's just going to be easier now that Agnes of Mehan had died, that it sort of opened up the possibility of resolving it in a sort of cleaner way. I don't know, Sean, whether you would agree with that.
I'd agree with that. And we could add that, although I suppose we might say on paper, Philip agreed to take Ingeborg back as his wife. It's fairly clear they never really lived together in any meaningful way. And all the way through the end of his reign, Philip finally dies in 1223. She is kept at a very notable physical distance, and she outlives him. So she is still the Dowager Queen of France until her death in the 1230s.
And it should be said that the children that Philip had with his third wife, with Agnes of Mehan, were technically, in the eyes of the church, illegitimate. And one of Philip's great efforts was to have the church legitimize them, which I think finally happens.
Innocent III did finally agree to that as part of the sort of reconciliation process. And that's another thing that Rigord shakes his head at. He says he can't really believe that the church went along with this. It's another element of not severe criticism, but clear criticism on his part.
It's just kind of funny because, well, I'm no fan of King John. One of the things that people really give him trouble for is placing England under interdict. But Philip, who's called Augustus, also did. So it's kind of a funny point. But let's come to John, because this is kind of where Rigord's part of the chronicle peters out. Maybe he died, stopped writing for whatever reason. But Philip has got John on the run. So what's their relationship like moving into the time when John becomes king? What's going on between those two?
Well, let's just get the narrative, Philip, up to date. Richard the Lionheart finally does return from the Third Crusade in 1199, and there's warfare resumes between the two kings. And Richard dies in 1199 in warfare from an arrow he receives at one of the Chateau Fort in doing those exercises. And then King John comes to the throne in 1199 and continues those efforts.
At first, there's a peacemaking moment where John's niece, Blanche of Castile, is married to the heir to the French throne, Louis VIII, the future Louis VIII. But then rapidly, as many of your listeners will know this famous story, John begins to alienate many of his barons by his high-handed decision to snatch away the fiancée of one of his most important French barons, a woman named Isabelle of Angoulême, and he marries her. And so the aggrieved party there is Hugh of Lusignan, who works with Philip Augustus to insist that John has to be called to his overlord's court, Philip Augustus's court, to answer for these transgressions. And John refuses. And so Philip declares all of John's French lands forfeit. And this is enormously important because, going back to the days of John's father, Henry II, the English kings are also the Dukes of Normandy and the Counts of Anjou and the Dukes of Aquitaine. So the lands at stake are enormously extensive. But of course, for the French king to simply declare that John's lands are forfeit is meaningless unless it can be, you know, backed up militarily. And in fact, John turns out not to put up a very good fight. And precisely because of his kind of underhanded behavior that tend to alienate his own barons, they largely go over to Philip Augustus's cause. And between about 1202 and 1204, Philip is able to really and truly take possession of, most importantly, Normandy and Anjou, and probably to his own great surprise, suddenly finds that he has now vastly expanded the real area of French royal control and has made himself far more powerful, far more wealthy than he had been a decade before.
There's just an enormous moment in the history of France when it takes Normandy, and in the history of the Anglo-Norman kingdom, because they lose Normandy. And John is furious and humiliated, and he spends the next decade plotting his revenge, or plotting to both retake his lands and regain control of what he considers his lost patrimony. And so he teams up with Otto of Brunswick, who is a claimant to the empire, and they organize an invasion, a two-pronged invasion, one from the north coming down and one coming in from the southwest, from Aquitaine, on the idea of they're coming in towards the Île-de-France, the French heartland, from two sides. And it was a real threat. It would be interesting to think through what would have happened had that been successful. But it is part of the great victory and, you know, advanced narrative of Philip's reign and of the development of the French monarchy and the development of France, that Philip quite extraordinarily turned both of those back. In fact, Louis, his son, Louis VIII, oversaw operations in the southwest, and Philip himself oversaw operations in the north, and particularly in a very consequential battle called the Battle of Bouvines in 1214. Philip decisively defeated Otto of Brunswick, and really the invasion was over. The long-term outcomes of this are many. Within the narrative of English history that you know, of course, so well, is the notion that Bouvines led directly to the Magna Carta, because John, after this huge defeat, went back and his barons were like, this has got to stop, all this money, all this catastrophe, all this loss. This is, of course, where John gets his nickname, John Lackland, because he keeps losing all his lands. And so in that sense, in terms of the development of England and England becoming again, until the Hundred Years' War, an island nation, much more is consequential in any number of ways. In France, it, of course, solidifies the French king, Philip, as the preeminent power. And if you think about Philip's position in 1180, when he was looking at his senior elder statesman, King Henry II, on the throne in England, there would be no question who was the more authoritative, powerful king. By 1214, things had been utterly reversed. It should be said, Rigaud's narrative stops at this point. He finishes his chronicle in 1206. So the fact of Philip as Augustus, so did we talk about where he got that moniker? Rigaud talks about Philip as Augustus for enlarging the lands, but that was, in fact, before he had done most of his enlarging of the lands. He really fulfilled that. So he ends his chronicle, his version of the chronicle in 1206, and the chronicle is picked up, or the story is picked up, by another man named Guillaume Breton, William the Briton, who participated, who went on Bouvines, and for whom it's really the great climactic moment of Philip's illustrious reign. And he will take the story of Philip's reign through to the end, through to his death.
I think Rigaud gets all the best bits and really gets to show up why Philip is called Augustus. And I think that this is probably a good place for us to wrap things up, for people to understand why Philip is still called Augustus. I mean, it's pretty fun to have a nickname for somebody that is so, well, illustrious. You don't usually get them. In French, it's usually the bald or the fat. But I think you've given us a good overview of why Philip was called Augustus, why he was such an important king in his time. And the chronicle is just so readable. I mean, congratulations to Larry and congratulations to you too, because I think this is going to be a really important book for people to read, whether they're students or just interested in the Middle Ages.
That's very, very kind of you. We had intended it for, we envisioned it for our own classrooms and for students. And that was really what it's designed for.
It's just super readable. I think lots of people will enjoy it. Thank you so much for joining me to talk about Philip Augustus and this chronicle specifically.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us on, Danielle.
To find out more about Cecilia's work, you can follow her on Twitter at Gaposchkin or visit her page at faculty-directory.dartmouth.edu/Cecilia-Gaposchkin. You can find Sean at cas/history/profiles/Sean-L-Field. And you can find Cecilia, Sean, and Larry F. Field on academia.edu. Before we go, here's Peter from medievalist.net to tell us what's on the website. What's new, Peter?
Hey, hey. Well, I did a piece on dungeons. And there's no more quintessential thing about the Middle Ages than dungeons, right?
Except for dragons.
Exactly. But I'm saying that medieval dungeons are not medieval. I know. It's so odd. But, you know, you take a closer look at these kind of dungeons. And I gave like the example of like this place in the Tower of London called Little Ease. Was it really a dungeon? In Middle Ages, did they use castles as dungeons where they kept lots of people in little crevices in the basement? That's not quite true. It's not really true, but it's more that something gets partially invented by writers, your Ivanhoe novels and stuff like that, and everything since. But kind of show how it kind of develops, right? Where once castles don't really become used as fortresses and stuff like that, funny enough, they figure out, like, we got to make use of these places. Otherwise, they get torn down and turned into people's cottages.
That's not where I thought you were going with that. But yeah. All right, you're going to be blowing people's minds left and right with this article. Yeah. I can't wait to read it.
Yeah, so I've got that. And I might be something I might do more often, because I did a piece on why torture devices are not medieval. So dungeons are not medieval. So I hope people enjoy reading that. We've got that. A wonderful article from Hannah Vadine on tips on learning Old English, like how to start, what books, what websites, things to get you going if you want to learn Old English. And she's the expert for that, right?
I mean, you can start by listening to my podcast episode with her, with Hannah, not all that long ago, and then read the article and get even more resources, right?
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah.
So we've got that, plus the story of 15,000 blinded captives by Basil the Bulgar Slayer. Is that really true? Did he actually blind 15,000 men?
Wow, you are just busting myths left and right.
And we're just getting some details about this really interesting discovery of the Czech Republic, of a kitchen that was discovered, medieval kitchen that had looked like it had been sealed up. It was from the early 15th century, and the finds there are pretty impressive. Pots with their lids on and all these kind of things. Whatever this building, this house was, it was abandoned in a very quick, because it seemed to be burned down, most of it, and it was abandoned, and they just kind of rediscovered it.
Wow, I missed that news while I was on vacation. I cannot wait to see the pictures. I'm sure that is amazing.
Well, welcome back.
Thank you. I'm happy to be back.
Plus, a reminder, we have our course, The Viking Age with Terry Barnes. It's starting September 9th, a 6-week course as we're running it through Thinkific. If you're looking at a direct URL, it's medievalstudies.thinkific.com. You can sign up there. You can also visit through our website. We give all the directions. And we're really excited about starting to offer online classes.
And people are already starting to sign up. It's super exciting.
It's very exciting to see the pop up in your email. Like, oh, you have a new buyer. Yay.
Yeah. So, a new student going to be learning about Vikings. That's super exciting. I'm so glad that that's starting up. And I think that there's going to be lots of interest in it. So medievalstudies.thinkific.com, right?
That's right.
Perfect. All right. Thanks, Peter. It sounds like you got lots of stuff going on.
Yeah, we're trying to keep busy. And as schools and universities kind of start up, it's only going to get busier here on in for us at medievalist.net.
Perfect. Well, good luck to you, and I'll speak to you next week.
See ya.
Thank you to everyone who supports this podcast through medievalist.net's page at patreon.com. I hope you're enjoying all the great rewards on offer, like subscriptions to the Medieval Magazine and Medieval World Magazine, as well as ad-free versions of medievalist.net. Your patronage keeps this podcast going, as well as supporting the work of other contributors, many of whom, like me, are indie historians trying to bring you the latest and greatest in medieval studies. If you've enjoyed this episode, tell your friends. And hey, why not sign up at patreon.com/medievalists? For everything from royalty to rogation, follow medievalist.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalists. You can find me, Danielle Sabolsky, on social media at 5MIN Medievalist or 5-Minute Medievalist. And you can find my books at all your favorite bookstores, where you can get hold of How to Live Like a Monk, Medieval Wisdom for Modern Life, in hardcover, ebook, and audiobook. You can also find my new digital downloads at daniellesabolsky.com/shop. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thanks for listening, and have yourself an awesome day.